Well, good morning. It just doesn't feel like Sunday without choir practice. It is just unsettling to me. I thought about wearing my favorite summer outfit, shorts and a t-shirt, but I didn't think it would be wise to push things that much. Dwayne, I got to think about how I want to think about that. Maybe tonight I will. When we get there in a few minutes, Genesis 22 will be our passage this morning. Genesis 22. Good to have you here. Coming up on a couple of busy weeks in the church calendar, singing group from Pensacola Thursday night. Next week, Vacation Bible School. Complete and total collapse of the church family the Sunday after that. So let's go ahead and pray, and we will begin this morning. Father, I pray that you would help us to know your word, to be familiar with it, and not simply to know the words, but to be familiar with the meaning and the sentiment, and to be able to see your hand clearly in all that is occurring, not just in our lives, but in the world, and to think about these things properly. And so we pray for myself and for each other that we would be able to do this, that we would have strong faith and understanding in your way in the world. And I pray then your blessing upon our Sunday school hour and our services today. In Jesus' name, amen. This morning, we are going to begin what probably will end up being a somewhat lengthy Sunday school series on the subject matter of God's providence. And we will come back and circle around and I'll talk to you about what I mean. We are, however, I'm just mentioning this for informational purposes, and probably I'm going to try and do this sometime in September. I'm thinking not beginning Labor Day, but September, October. We're going to take probably just 3 or 4 weeks, maybe 4 weeks, and I'm going to do a class for guys, and I've asked Carol Peterson if she would teach a ladies' Sunday school class, and so I will divvy up, but then when we come back at the end of September, the middle of October, whenever it is, we'll come back to this subject of providence. The word providence is not found in the Bible, at least not in any of the translations that that we would be familiar with. But the concept really is everywhere in the Bible. And so this morning, I just kind of want to introduce the topic and the subject matter and give a little bit of consideration to what we will develop in much greater detail as we go. And as always, I think you probably know this with, you know, we're trying to be scripture oriented and always looking for helpful sources. Recently, John Piper put out into publication a book on providence that is already being widely regarded as probably the best book on the subject that has ever been. And so we'll use that, or I will use that. You may certainly encourage, get your own copy and find that helpful. We are familiar with the word and the concept of God's sovereignty. Sovereignty refers to God's absolute right to do anything. One verse that puts it succinctly is Psalm 115:3, but our God is in the heavens. He hath done whatsoever he hath pleased. God is sovereign. He answers to no one. And not only does God answer to no one, God counsels with no one. God has never sought advice. And this is not from a position of arrogance. This is simply a function of his deity. There is nothing that he does not know, and there is nothing that he cannot do, and there is no dilemma that is too complex for him or anything that is too far out into the future for him to anticipate. He is sovereign. He does what he wishes. But providence, while certainly falling under the umbrella of God's sovereignty, providence is different than God's sovereignty. God's sovereignty is God's right to do anything he wishes. God's providence is the way the Bible describes the things that he does. And I think that we would have to understand then that included in that, God's providence includes the things that he will not do. He can do anything. He can do anything that is not sinful. But he does not do everything. He does not do everything that we wish him to do. And very often the things that he does do, we struggle with and wish that he would do them differently. So providence then, right? God functions in providence from his position of sovereignty. Providence then is, I think we could think of it this way, is the sovereignty of God in action. What is he doing? And how does he do it? And to what end is he doing it? The word providence itself is not really even, it's not a natively an English word, and it's certainly not a Greek word. It is actually a Latin word. And the word refers to, as you can, if you just think about it, providio, providence, to see ahead, to be able to see out into the future. When we bring that thought into the Bible and into God's activity, then we are talking about God's use of not simply his sovereignty, but all of his attributes to bring about those things that he desires and to supply those things that are necessary for both our service and for the accomplishment of his will. And one of the things that we want to remember when we think about God's providence, and this is really, I think, a very large task for us, is that God is not simply functioning from a position of awareness. Right? It's one thing to say that, right? I mean, Jesus told us specifically, right? And with this is not really the subject matter, but right? Jesus gave, when in part of his instruction to us about praying, what does one of the things that Jesus tells us is this: you know, your praying never informs God of anything. He already knows what you need. So obviously then, folks, when we respond, and I'm digressing a little bit, then our prayer should not ever in any way, shape, or form come from the perspective that we need to tell God something that's going on, as if there's any form of announcement dimension to our prayers. I'm mentioning this because I want you to know this, but God already knows that. God has that knowledge. Providence is not simply what God knows. It is not simply that God knows that we need to eat and God knows that we need clothes to wear. It is God working specifically and directly in the lives of every single individual to bring about his will, to bring about those things that he wishes. In other words, it is an activity of God, not just simply an intellectual dimension of God. God has sovereign power, folks. We understand this. God can do anything. God can do anything. But he doesn't do everything. And, right, what you can expect him to do, by the way, we can always expect him. In fact, I think that our faith would go beyond that. Our faith would insist that he does those things that he promised to do. But he doesn't always do everything that he can do. He is sovereign. Sometimes the exercise of his will is to do nothing at all or to do something differently. Providence is how that plays out. God is never, folks. And I don't want to get into all of this. If you pick up the book, and again, it's a long book, but probably worth the read. You know, he quotes a variety of people who talk about the extent of God's providence. But what I want us to understand is that God is an actor, not an observer to human events. And of course, we could, you know, kind of back that up. This would be one of the great distinctions between the deism of the 19th century or the 18th century and true practicing Christianity, was that God created a world that has the ability to operate, and he went off to do other things, so to speak, while the world operates. But the Bible paints a completely different picture, that God is actively working, not just simply an observer of human events. And the Puritans used to put it this way, right? Because we want to make sure that we understand this distinction. We're not talking about fate. As Christians, we are not fatalistic. And the Puritans would make this distinction. They said, fate is blind. Fate is blind. Just random things happen to random people. But providence has eyes, right? God is not simply acting, but God is acting deliberately with purpose in the lives of individuals. Right, so that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the activity of God in the course of human history, both with reference to nations and individuals, for the outworking of his will, for the accomplishment of his purposes. Right? So with that, turn if you would to Genesis chapter 22. And here is very early in the Bible story, a very clear account of God's providence in action. Well, again, without using the word, as we would have it, providence, but the word is there. I think we will be able to see the word is there in our English. All right, Genesis chapter 22 and verse number 1. And it came to pass after these things that God did tempt Abraham. And that means to, obviously, right, if I can interject here, to put him to the test, not entice him to do wrong. Right? But we're gonna put Abraham, so to speak, on the treadmill, and we're going to find out how he does. So after these things, God did tempt Abraham and said unto him, Abraham, and he said, Behold, here am I. Here I am. And he said, Take now thy son, thine only son Isaac, whom thou lovest, get thee into the land of Moriah, and offer him there for a burnt offering upon one of the mountains which I will tell thee of. And Abraham rose up early in the morning, and saddled his ass, and took two of his young men with him, and Isaac his son, and clave the wood for the burnt offering, and rose up and went unto the place of which God had told him. Then on the third day Abraham lifted up his eyes, and saw the place afar off. And Abraham said unto his young men, Abide ye here with the ass, and I and the lad will go yonder and worship and come again to you. And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it upon Isaac his son, and he took the fire in his hand and a knife, and they went both of them together. And Isaac spake unto Abraham his father, and said, My father. And he said, Here am I, my son. And he said, Behold the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering? And Abraham said, My son, God will provide himself a lamb for a burnt offering. So they went both of them together. And they came to the place of which God had told him of. And Abraham built an altar there and laid the wood in order and bound Isaac his son and laid him on the altar upon the wood. And Abraham stretched forth his hand, took the knife to slay his son. And the angel of the Lord called unto him out of heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, Here am I. And he said, Lay not thine hand upon the lad, neither do thou anything unto him, for now I know that thou fearest God, seeing thou hast not withheld thy son, thine only son, from me. And Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him a ram caught in a thicket by his horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered him up for a burnt offering in the stead of his own son, of his son. And Abraham called the name of that place Jehovah Jireh, as it is said to this day, In the mount of the Lord it shall be seen. And the angel of the Lord called unto Abraham out of heaven the second time, and said, By myself have I sworn, saith the Lord, for because thou hast done this thing and hast not withheld thy son, thine only son, that in blessing I will bless thee, multiplying I will multiply thee. Thy seed is the stars of the heaven, as the sand which is upon the seashore, and thy seed shall possess the gate of his enemies. And in thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because thou hast obeyed my voice. This is contextually, by the way, kind of the final test, the final piece of the puzzle, of Abraham being the recipient of, as repeated here, this Abrahamic covenant, which is first mentioned in Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 through 6. And so, you know, when we've kind of walked through that, Genesis 12 and 13, 14, 15, 17, we have components of the Abrahamic covenant, which has, again, the four dimensions to it. Now this, again, if I can just kind of do this, this is just off at a tangent, but it's worth putting into our intellects. When you and I read Genesis 22, 1 through 18, it is obvious, abundantly obvious, that we have here anticipating the work of Christ. Right? The work of Christ, clearly. The only begotten Son offered in substitution, sacrificed. But an interesting, and it really is a theological question, is, did Abraham understand that? Did Abraham see the work of Christ? And was he required to see the work of Christ? Again, that's not really where I'm trying to go with it this morning, but when we read these Bible stories, folks, we have to remember that we have the great luxury of being able to look back over the complete and total story of the Bible. And we can see things in hindsight, as we always do, much more clearly than people who are looking out into the future can see. And I would just mention that it was required of Abraham to believe God and to respond to the commands of God. But it was not theologically necessary for Abraham to understand that this was Jesus who was going to be offered in the place of his son. Not like we need to understand that, but that's neither here nor there. Okay, to go back to the idea of providence. What does the word providence mean? It's a Latin word that means to see before. And in this little section here, in which Abraham is given his, so to speak, final test, God did test Abraham, we have this idea of vision that is really dominant through the passage. If you look at verse number 4, then on the third day Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place afar off. Right? There's no mystery there, folks. There's no analogy there. Right? They've been 3 days on a journey, and on that day Abraham looks out into the distance and he sees the place that God had told him to attend, to visit. Down to verse number 8. And I'm going to, if I can, translate the Hebrew for you as I read Hebrews 22:8. Right? Isaac says, okay, Dad, right? We've got the wood. Right? We've got the wood. And if you look at verse number 7, we've got the fire and we've got the wood. But we don't have anything to sacrifice. So it's obvious, by the way, at this point in time in the narrative, that Isaac doesn't understand what his role is supposed to be. Right? He and Dad haven't spent 3 days talking about the fact that, son, I know this sounds crazy. Right? I mean, I just know this sounds absolutely crazy, but here's what's going to happen. Right? We're going to go out into the wilderness here. I'm going to tie you to an altar and I'm going to kill you because God told me to. They're not having that conversation. Because Isaac is completely clueless. Dad, I know what we got to have here. We got the wood and we got the fire, but we don't have anything to sacrifice. That brings us to verse number 8. Abraham said, My son, God will see to the lamb. God will see to it. That's the word. That's the providence. God will see to the lamb. That's what he said. That's the way the Hebrew reads. That's the way the Hebrew ear would hear. God will see to the lamb. Where is the sacrifice? God will see to the sacrifice. And he didn't just send us on this errand into the wilderness in the hopes that there would be some animal that we could sacrifice. God will see to it. God will provide for it. He will see in advance. Verse number 13. Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked. Again, in the Hebrew, saw. Just nothing mystical, nothing magical about it. Just Abraham exercised the vision that God gave him. And behold, behind him a ram caught in a thicket by his horns. God saw to the sacrifice. God will see to it. God will see to it. And then verse number 14, right? This is why we have this. And you probably have some kind of a note in your study Bible that would put it this way. Abraham called the place, the name of that place, Jehovah Jireh. Jehovah Jireh. As it is said to this day, in the mount of the Lord it shall be seen. God saw to it. That's the point that is being made, folks. This is a clear, vivid, beautiful, encouraging explanation of the providence of God. God said to Abraham, go do this. You can imagine Abraham being a total normal human being going. Now, Paul is very clear, right? Paul is very helpful here that Abraham took his son and fully expected that what he was going to do was kill his son on the altar. And he fully expected that what God was going to do was raise Isaac from the dead. That was Abraham's logical assumption and conclusion about the events. Okay, I'm going to go do this. I'm going to kill my son, and somehow God is going to resurrect him. That's Abraham's logic. But in the providence of God, here is what God is going to do. God saw to it. See what a really big theme this is, folks? That all of these things that God is doing and all of these things that God demands of us, in all of the times, folks, all of the times, this is one of the reasons that God is critical of our faith, is because we don't see what God sees, and so we think it's not there. Boy, I know the Lord told me to do that, but I just don't see any way that that would ever work. I can't afford to do that. I could never do that. But we don't have providence. God has providence. God has providence. We're supposed to do what we're told. We're not supposed to stand there and debate it as if we are talking with a peer. I know that's what you said, Lord, but you know, you just don't have any idea that this is not going to work. The providence of God is a monumental subject. And so the story really in some way concludes, right, with verse number 14. I mean, this is kind of the climax of the event, right? That the Lord sees, the Lord will see to it. And in fact, sometimes we actually use that kind of language, don't we? We say to somebody, see to it that this gets done. See to it that you get these tasks accomplished. And that is the way that the word is being used there. So, providence is God's foresight, so to speak. Not just in an intellectual sense. It is God seeing ahead to bring about all those things that are necessary for him to accomplish what he has commanded and what he desires. And so that brings me then, again, I'm just dealing with this in kind of an introductory sense, and we may get done very early today, which would just be providential, so don't. Just wondered if you were listening. I do want to touch upon this. How intricate is the providence of God? How intricate is the providence of God? Well, we know that God holds all things together. In fact, look at Hebrews chapter 1, if you wouldn't, to go back to the to a very early observation about Jesus in Hebrews 1:3. Jesus is the subject matter, Hebrews 1:2, who being the brightness of his glory, the express image of his person, and upholding all things by the word of his power. And we know from the book of Colossians that he created all things and by him all things consist. But I would argue, if we were trying to get technical, that those are more kind of expressions of technical sovereignty than they are of providence. How far does providence go? Well, Spurgeon told his congregation that every speck of dust they saw in the sunlight was under the control of God. And I wouldn't argue about that, but let me give you a clear Bible statement on the extent of the providence of God. Matthew chapter 10. Matthew chapter 10 and verse number 29. Are not two sparrows sold for a farthing? In other words, sparrows are very inexpensive. I don't know what you could buy two of for a penny anymore. Is there anything left you can buy two of for a penny? Do we even want pennies anymore? Do any of you collect pennies? I know Rick, they're out of town this week, but Rick collects pennies. Rick collects everything, but another subject matter. The point that Jesus is making, folks, right, is, are not two sparrows sold for a farthing? Something that is incredibly cheap. Something that, because it is cheap, is therefore relatively insignificant. This is the argument that Jesus is making. And one of them shall not fall on the ground without your Father. Now you notice that the sentence ends there. Please do not add any words to that sentence. Please do not add the word knowledge to the end of the sentence, because the word knowledge isn't there, it doesn't belong there. Jesus is not making the point that God can keep inventory of sparrows. That's not the point he's making. He knows the quantity. Oh, one died, now there's one less, but that's okay, I know that. He is making the point that they don't die without the Father. How far does the providence of God go? To what minute dimension is God working all things in this world according to his will for his purposes, right down to an insignificant bird that you can buy two for a penny? And that brings that right, that helps you understand the greater framework of the entire passage. And this is one of the reasons, folks, that to have a well-grounded respect for the providence of God is so essential for us. So that, right, because here's the way we tend, some people talk about things as if all things are accidental. Random acts of fate, which if you are really truly a hardcore evolutionist, I don't know what other conclusion you could draw. Right? What other conclusion is there? If all things began by chance and occurred by chance and randomly happened, then how is not everything that happened to your life equally a random event? Most people in churches like ours don't make that statement. But most people in churches like ours make statements like this. I don't know why God would let that happen. as if God somehow is sitting over in a chair observing all things, stroking his long white beard going, not sure I would have done that. That's not the Bible picture at all, folks. The Bible picture is he's doing it. Or specifically, he is not doing it. Not simply that he is observing it and wishing that it wasn't to be that way. And look, this gets very deep very quickly, and it becomes very complicated very quickly. And God's people have been trying to explore the harmony between God's righteousness and evil in the world. Does this make God the author of evil? No, it does not make God the author of evil. So is there not a sense in which God allows evil? Yes, God allows evil. But the providence of God is not about doing evil. The providence of God is about God doing good. Evil is a stipulated reality. But folks, right? Never think for a moment that there's any kind of equality between God and Satan. You go right to the early part of the book of Job. God doesn't appear before Satan. Satan appears before God. God never asks permission. Satan asks permission. It is a completely unequal relationship. It is the relationship of a creator and one of his creations. So, right, the things that happen to us, right? And, well, turn if you would to Philippians chapter 1. Here's a... Here is a man who I think had a healthy respect for the biblical doctrine of providence. Philippians chapter 1. And verse number 12, right? Not accidents, folks. As believers, we do not experience accidents. Now, there is certainly and clear, because God is not the main actor in evil, so there is a sense in which God has allowed evil to function and has allowed the evil one to wield influence and dominance in this world. When we talk about, right, it is the providence of God that is bringing good out of evil. It is the providence of God that is working deliberately and specifically in our lives, in spite of the evil, or in the face and the presence of the evil. Right, so here's Philippians, and you know, of course, that Paul is in jail. About which he writes in verse number 12, but I would ye should understand, brethren, I want you guys to get this, that the things which have happened unto me have fallen out rather unto the furtherance of the gospel. Because there is a God who sees. There is a God who sees. Let me give you one other verse that goes along that way. Paul, again, preaching, Acts chapter 17. In verse number 22, this, of course, is Paul's famous sermon on Mars Hill. Verse number 22, then Paul stood in the midst of Mars Hill and said, ye men of Athens, I perceive that in all things ye are too superstitious. For as I passed by and beheld your devotions, I found an altar with this inscription, to the unknown God, whom therefore ye ignorantly worship, him declare I unto you. Now listen how Paul begins to explain this to these men of Athens. God that made the world and all things therein, right? That's sovereignty, providence, creation. Seeing that he is Lord of heaven and earth, dwelleth not in temples made with hands. Which is another subject, but right, but But folks, when we're worshiping the Lord, we're worshiping a God who created heaven. So we should never try to confine him bodily or building-wise. This is one of the failings of false religion. Verse number 25, neither is worshipped with men's hands as though he needed anything, seeing he giveth to all life and breath and all things, providence. And hath made of one blood all nations of men for to dwell on the face of the earth. And hath determined the times before appointed. One of the guys gave me a link to a interview, a podcast interview of a man who in 2014 predicted the Russian invasion of the Ukraine in 2022. He said, here's what's going to happen. He went on to explain why it was going to happen. So 8 years ago, he made the prediction that it would happen. Now again, God is not the author of evil and God is not the author of confusion, but I would refer you, right, to verse, to Hebrew, to Acts 17, 26, hath made of one blood all nations of men for to dwell on the face of the earth and hath determined the times before appointed. God has not been simply an observer of world events, of the ebb and flow of kingdoms. And the bounds of their habitation, in his providence, God has made some of us, Americans, Europeans, Africans, Asians, and of course we could narrow that down even further. But folks, this is the providential work of deity. This is how the Bible would explain it. This is why people are the ethnicities that they are. But God has not even finished there because he has an additional purpose described in verse number 27, that they should seek the Lord. That they should seek the Lord. If haply they might feel after him and find him, though he be not far from every one of us. Which I've mentioned many times, folks, the gist of the text is that God put people where he put them and made them what he made them so as to give them the best opportunity that they would have to come to know him. Which is far more important than any of the demographics we pursue, like GDP and clean water. That they might seek him. This is the providence of God. How far does it go? And then one last point, and I'll deal with this quickly. Turn, if you would, to Isaiah chapter 48. Right, now, these are things that we will explore over the course of however long we take. Right, that God sees to making it possible that those things that he commands and instructs and expects from his people are accomplished. That if he tells us to do something, he will give us the resources to do it. That if he tells us something must be done, then there is a way for us to do it because God is providential. He is active. He is active and he is working. And Genesis 22 is a good place to go to refresh our memories. And this is extensive. It's not like God is providential only in those things that pertain to my salvation. That God worked things out in a way that brought me to come to know Christ. But that he is working all things, that his providence is extensive. Down to small matters. That the ultimate purpose of this, folks, and this should be one of our great treasures and anchoring spots, we should not recoil this, is because God is doing this for his own benefit. He's doing this for his own glory. Isaiah chapter 48. And of course, in Isaiah, we're 150 years approximately away from the Babylonian captivity. It is still a long way in the future as humans would count. And God is telling the people that they need to change the way they live, but he is predicting that they're not going to and that this is going to happen. And then he is predicting that that is not going to be the final word on Israel. And you have verse number 9 of Isaiah 48. For my name's sake will I defer mine anger, and for my praise will I refrain for thee, that I cut thee not off. Behold, I have refined thee, but not with silver. I have chosen thee in the furnace of affliction. Providence. For mine own sake, even for mine own sake will I do it. For how should my name be polluted, and I will not give my glory unto another? Now, of course, we who anticipate a future for ethnic Israel find those verses a great treasure, but notice the great motivator there for all that God does, for the greatness of his name. For the greatness of his name. This is, right? So sometimes I would like God to wield his sovereign power providentially in such a way to get this thing accomplished or to get this thing prevented. This is what I'm asking God to do. And it is not that God is indifferent to our suffering or impervious to our tears. It is that God is doing something else. Something that is ultimately far greater and a far more lasting benefit to us. So that is why God is working in the minutiae of human lives and working to bring about his purposes. Okay, and we'll explore that in greater detail. I'm going to stop there. 10:45. Perfect, just perfect timing. See you in a bit.